Okay, welcome, everybody. Today is a discussion which is entitled Teshuvah, which is the Hebrew word for repentance, let's say, at this point in time. Teshuvah in three easy jokes. So the first joke is about this young lady that visits a local shadchan, a matchmaker. And she says, I'm looking for a companion, spouse. Can you please find me a suitable one? So the shadchan, the matchmaker, says, what are you looking for? You know, what are your requirements? So she said, well, let me see. He needs to be good-looking, polite, humorous, sporty, knowledgeable, good at singing and dancing. He has to be willing to spend quality time with me in our home if I don't want to go out. He must also tell me interesting stories, and he should be a constant companion for me, but when I want to rest, he should be totally silent and let me rest. So the shadchan listens carefully, and then replies, okay, I think I understand. You're looking for a television set. I won't give up my day job, don't worry. All right, so basically, nobody's perfect. And that is the first step in tshuva, in repentance, is understanding that we're all flawed, that nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. Like this man who told his wife, he said, I never made a mistake. He said, well, once back in 74, I thought I made a mistake. So the wife says, what happened? He said, I was mistaken. So that was one of the three jokes, by the way. That was just thrown in there. So basically, I would say that if any of you are perfect, then you may leave. You don't have to listen to this, because tshuva may not apply to you. So the first thing is that we are human, and because we're human, we do make mistakes. We do slip up, we do fall, we do stumble, and therefore there is a mechanism in place that God put into this world called tshuva, a great gift called repentance that can help us rectify our past. Now, it's interesting that the very definition, medical definition of life, or representation of life, the representation of life in medicine is the electrocardiograph. An electrocardiograph is a series of peaks and valleys, a line that goes up and down, and that is the sign of life. When the line flatlines, when it becomes a steady, straight line, then it is not anymore alive, it is now a symbol of the opposite of life. Because if you're alive, then by definition, you do a little bit better sometimes, you do a little bit worse sometimes, you go up, you go down, you fall, you're in, you're out. That's a sign that you're a living being. If you were perfect, you would never change, you would be constant, everything would remain constant, and there would be no reason to have repentance or a concept of teshuva. It's interesting that at a wedding, at the end of a wedding, the groom breaks a glass. That is, and then everybody goes, oh, mazel tov, and people think that if you haven't broken the glass, then you're not married, but that's not true. It's just a custom that is added on to the end, and has many interesting symbolisms, but one of the symbolic representations of breaking the glass that I'm very fond of is that it teaches you that you're not marrying an angel. There's going to be lots of broken glass and clumsiness and failures, and that's fine. Right after you break the glass, everybody calls out mazel tov, because that, just like when a child is born, you say mazel tov, because that is a sign of life. Making a mistake and it is not the end of the world. And in fact, it is a part of our growth. There's a plant here, a species of plant in Australia called the Banksia plant. And it's some of the subspecies in the Banksia family have a very interesting characteristic. They have a pod, and the pod contains within it all seeds. And those seeds are trapped inside the pod and cannot be released unless there is a fire. If there's a fire, a bushfire, then the bushfire actually melts the pod that holds the seeds, and that's what releases them. So even though a fire is a terribly devastating thing, it's a great tragedy here in Australia, in the state of Victoria, we've suffered from bushfires at great cost to property and even more importantly to life. So, you know, it's a bad thing to have a bushfire, but for a Banksia plant, it's actually a very good thing. So sometimes when we fail, that is part of our growth, and that's very important. So we don't marry television sets, we marry human beings who will break glasses and break hearts every now and then, and that is fine. There is nothing that cannot be repaired because of the power of teshuvah. Now, it's interesting, the very word teshuvah is mistranslated into English as being repentance. And I say mistranslated because repentance implies that you are not deserving of the of what you're receiving. In other words, you plead to God, even though you're not deserving, he should forgive you, and he forgives you. And that is what repentance means. Teshuvah actually comes from the Hebrew word shuv, which means to return. It restores and returns you to the point that you were prior to your failure. And that point, for all people, we believe every person has a soul, a neshama, and that soul is perfect, and the person connects to that neshama, and that is what allows the person to... And that's how teshuvah works. Which brings me to my second joke. It's about a man who comes to his rabbi. And he comes to his rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, I did something very bad, and I need to have a tikkun. I sinned, I need a tikkun. A tikkun means I need to repair that which I broke." So the rabbi says, "Sure, let's see if I can help. What did you do?" And the man squirms a little bit in his seat, he's a little bit embarrassed, and he says, "Rabbi, it happened once," and he sighs, "that I ate bread without ritually washing my hands before eating the bread." So the rabbi thinks to himself, could be worse. That's not the end, you know, it's not the worst thing a human being has ever done. And, you know, I was just having a conversation yesterday with a woman congregant, and we were talking about how cruel people could be. And I remembered some incidents that happened in my career as a rabbi, some things that I've seen, how cruel and hurtful people can be to each other. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, some of these stories that I remembered, you know, having a... eating a sandwich without first washing is probably not one of the worst things that a rabbi's ever heard in his life. I'll give you an example. One of these a family that I knew, the husband passed away, and in his will he left his liquid assets to his wife, and the house, which was his largest asset, he left to his wife and three children. Each one had a quarter share in the home. So during Shiva, while the body wasn't cold yet, practically, and they were sitting around, and the kids said to the wife, to their mother, they said, "Ma, we need money, and so we've decided that we're going to sell the house." And the mother said to her children, "Look, you know, I feel Dad's presence in this home. I've been here for many, many years. I feel very comfortable. I wouldn't be able to live in such a high standard of living in such a nice house. So if it's all the same with you, I'll stay in the home, you know, in my home." And the kid said, "Ma, I don't think you understand. We own 3/4 of this home. We're just informing you. We're not asking you." By Shloshim, which is the 30-day anniversary of a person's passing, she was already living in a one-bedroom apartment in a very, very dilapidated area of town, while her children live in decent homes in the suburbs. And, you know, that's the type of cruelty that we see. So, hey, no worries. So this man comes to his rabbi, and he says, "Rabbi, I once ate bread without washing my hands." So I need to know, how can I rectify that? So the rabbi told him, it's not so bad. It could have done far worse. But tell me, what possessed you to not wash your hands? Like, why didn't you wash your hands? So the man says, it just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right to wash your hands. What are you talking about? He says, well, it was a non-kosher restaurant. So the rabbi says, what were you doing in a non-kosher restaurant? So the man says, all the kosher restaurants were closed. He says, why were all the kosher restaurants closed? He said, it was Yom Kippur. So you see how he's getting himself in more and more trouble as he goes along. And basically, in the end analysis, we are all responsible for our own actions. So you can, you know, who said that you should go and eat something on Yom Kippur? And then who said that you should go to a non-kosher restaurant? And then who said? So the whole domino effect going one another, but it all starts with the person's, with the choices that we make. And we all make choices constantly in life. That is our responsibility, to make choices. And then we have to live with the consequences of the choices, although we don't always like that. So, you know, a man standing on a building, on a rooftop, and he decides to jump. That is totally his choice. He jumps. When he hits the ground and he hurts himself, that is not a punishment as much as it is a consequence of that person's decisions that he made that led him up to that point. So, and ultimately, that decision, you know, my hero, Viktor Frankl, one of my heroes, said he was a psychologist who lived in through the war years, and he suffered in Auschwitz. And in Search for Meaning, one of the main points that he makes in that book, which sold over 11 million copies, did quite well, one of the most read books in history. And in Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl says that they can rob you of the world, the Nazis, whatever, could rob you of every single freedom. They can take every freedom and dignity away from you, but they cannot ultimately take away your choice. And if they can't take away your choice, then when you choose to behave in a certain way, then you are truly free. And they cannot actually capture you and imprison you, because you will always be able to make your own choices. So let me share with you a bizarre set of laws in the Torah, which I think have bearing on this discussion. So the Torah, there's a whole series or family of laws around, I would call it, ritual contamination. What's ritual contamination? Well, the Torah lavishes great deal of loving attention on this body of laws called ritual contamination, and you'll find most of the discussion in the third book of the Torah, in Vayikra, which is also known as the book that we skip over when we get there in the synagogue. Most Jews don't pay too much attention to those laws of ritual contamination. They don't seem to be too relevant, but I think it has some fascinating relevance to us, even if it's a little bit unfamiliar in our world. So first of all, just very briefly, if a person is in a state of, and I'll just use the word contamination for a moment, or tuma in Hebrew, then there are certain ritual activities, mostly to do with the temple that stood in Jerusalem, which you would be forbidden to participate in. So if a person finds himself in a state of tumah, he cannot attend certain rituals within the temple. In every case, there is a ritual cleansing from this contamination or this impurity, and it always involves water. So either immersion in water, somebody goes into a body of water, a special body of water called the mikveh, or pouring water over your hands to ritually wash and prepare your hands. So again, contamination, impurity, these are highly dysfunctional translations of the Hebrew word tumah, because it really doesn't have a translation into English. It is a state of being that you can get into and get out of. The way you get into it is, there's a whole bunch of ways. You come into physical contact with a cadaver, with a dead body. So So if you come into, if you touch a corpse, a human corpse, that would be one way that you would contract tumah. Or carcasses of certain animals, if you come into contact with them as well, you could contract tumah. If a man has a seminal emission at night, a nocturnal emission, then he also falls into that category. When a woman menstruates, she would fall into that category. When a woman gives birth, she again would become tame. And there was a supernaturally induced skin affliction in the Torah called tsara'at. Doesn't exist today, unknown to modern medicine, but vividly described in the Torah. It was a kind of a skin disease that people got. It's called leprosy, but leprosy is a modern medical condition. Tsara'at is more, probably a better translation would be psoriasis, a kind of a psoriasis, because it affected the skin. But it is really has no modern equivalent. It was a very spiritual disease. People got it for speaking ill about each other, and it was cured in a supernatural way. I mean, it has nothing to do with any modern disease. You know what they say at the end of a movie, any similarity between any person's living or dead is purely coincidental. Well, any similarities between tsara'at and a disease that we're aware of is purely coincidental. But nonetheless, a person who got tsara'at also became tame. So these are all the ways, and then the rabbis added another way, and that is when you sleep, that your hands become contaminated, and that's why when Jewish people wake up in the morning, religious people, they would take water in a jug and pour it alternately on each hand, three times on the left, three times on the right, alternating between them, and that ritually cleanses their hands. Again, the word cleanse is a bit unfortunate. It means move them from a state of tumah, which you get from all these things, into its opposite, which is a state of tahara, which is also sometimes translated into English as purity, but again, probably not an entirely helpful translation. So, there was a great scholar by the name of Samson Raphael Hirsch. He lived, he was born in 1808, he passed away in 1888, and he lived in Germany, and probably is the introduced, or was the first, so-called modern Orthodox rabbi. And don't forget that at the time that he lived, his contemporary was Darwin, and Darwin's philosophical framework, as we've discussed in previous classes, was that of materialism. In other words, he saw man's situation in the world as being entirely determined by material forces, not spiritual ones. And Hirsch said, of course, he argued with Darwin, and he said, through these ritual contamination laws, you can actually see that the Torah is attempting to inoculate us against the spirit-denying and nature-exalting worldview that achieved dominance through Darwin and other people. So, in other words, Hirsch said that in these laws of ritual impurity, the Torah is protecting us from a Darwinistic, materialistic view of the world. How so? Here's how it works. Every source of tumah, every source of this contamination, the spiritual contamination, bears a similarity and a resemblance to death. In that, it conveys a message that you are trapped in the limitations of nature. So, a dead body has been robbed of any possibility of making a free choice, a decision. It has been defeated by nature. That's what death is. When nature defeats a living being, that is death. So a human corpse is the most severe source of tumah that there is. All the other things, birth, menstruation, a seminal emission, this weird disease of tsara'at, the sleep, all of these things have one thing in common, and that is that a person temporarily or permanently, in the case of death, loses control of their body or of some bodily function, and that results in this event taking place. So therefore, tumah represents when we lose control, when we are not in control. And tara, going into water, represents when we come into control. There's a very interesting law with the washing of the hands. If you would go to a modern faucet, modern plumbing, and you would turn on your tap, and the water would run on your hands, and then you would turn off the tap, turn on, turn off, turn on, turn off, turn on, turn off. Would that be good enough to wash your hands from, to ritually move yourself, transition into a state of Tara? No. Why?
It's got to be the force of your hand.
There you go. It's got to be the force of your hand. Because the whole purpose of these laws is to teach you that you are in control. You determine your destiny. Things are not just happening to you. And you are powerless and a victim to these great forces in the universe that are conspiring against you. You have the ability to stand up and to say, no, I'm sorry, I want a different choice. I make a different choice for myself. I want to do something else. And that is the message of Teshuvah. So you can't say, it was Yom Kippur, so I had to go to a non-kosher, and all that domino effect. Because you have the choice not to eat on Yom Kippur. That is in your control. You have the choice about how you're going to react to everything and how what your attitude is going to be. You have the choice. And since you have the choice, therefore you create the reality, your reality, and you are therefore responsible for that reality that you create. You own it. You know, so I own a car. You cannot sell my car. You don't own it. It's not in your ability to sell. I can sell it though. Because it's mine. Because I own it. If you own your destiny, then you get to decide if it's going to be sold or not. If you're going to sell yourself short, or sell yourself down the river, or not. You get to decide all of this. And that's what tshuva is. Tshuva is that point where you get to decide that the past is going to be rewritten and you're going to have a whole new way of looking at things. A man, so the first, and really the first step in tshuva is to take personal responsibility. A man came to the Rebbe Marash, a great rabbi, and he came to the Rebbe Marash with a problem. What was the problem? He had done something terrible. He had done an awful sin, right? Done something he was highly embarrassed and ashamed. And he wanted the Rebbe Marash to guide him in tshuva, to guide him in repentance. So he comes to the Rebbe Marash and he says, but he can't say, I did this terrible thing. I mean, how embarrassing is that to go in front of the greatest rabbi alive and say, you know, hello, I did this and this and that. So what he did is he concocted a story and he said, I have a friend who did this and this and that. But he's too embarrassed to come and admit this to you. So he asked if I could go to you and tell you what he did. You would tell me how to fix it, how to rectify it. I'll go back to him and I'll tell him how to rectify it. So that's what he said. So Rebbe Marash looked at this man and he said, why did your friend have to send you? Why didn't he just come to me and pretend that he had a friend who did that? And tell me a story as if it's not happening to him, as if it's happening to the friend. And that way you wouldn't have to come on his, you know, on his behalf and do this whole rouge, you know. So the man realized that he's been caught. He got caught with his hand in the cookie jar. He got caught red-handed. So he said to the Rebbe Marash, he broke down crying, and he said, because it's me. I did that. The Rebbe Marash said, I know. Let's fix it. And then he guided him into rectifying that error that he had made. So my question, that's the story. So my question on the story is as follows. Always, as soon as I heard that story, many, many years ago, I had a question, and other people asked the question also, but I thought of that question. I said, why did the Rebbe Marash have to embarrass this individual? Clearly, the Rebbe Marash had prophetic vision, and he could see that this guy was making this whole convoluted story just to, you know, protect his shame, that he shouldn't be embarrassed. So why didn't Rebbe Marash allow him to have his story? He'll know the truth, that it's really this guy, but play along, be nice, right? Compassion, it's also a virtue. Be compassionate. Tell the guy, listen, oh, your friend should do this and this and this. You know it's him. But what do you have to embarrass him for? Why do you have to make him break him down that he has to admit to you that he's the one who did it? And the answer is, because until he took responsibility for his life, until he realized that it's really him, he could never begin to repair and fix what he had broken. So if he's coming and he's embarrassed and this, but he's not willing to take ownership of it, the whole thing's not going to work out. So that's what the laws of Tumah and Taharah teach us. That's what tshuva is all about. Tshuva is, I'm going to take responsibility for what I did in the past, not for what happened to me before what I did. You put your hand on a hot stove, it gets burnt. It's not a punishment. You decided to put your hand on the hot stove. It is an inevitable consequence of that action. That's why it's interesting. There's a medrash, Yalkut Shimoni. The Yalkut Shimoni says, four entities were asked what you should do if you sin. So they asked wisdom. Like, what should a person do if he sins? And wisdom answered, death will pursue him all his days. And he's finished. Then they asked prophecy. They said, prophecy, what should a person do if you sin? And prophecy said, the person's going to suffer. Now, why did wisdom and prophecy give these really negative responses? Because there are inevitable responses. If you do something bad, you know, like this guy, Shmuley, he stole the rabbi's golden watch. The rabbi had a nice Rolex watch, not one of these Chinese ripoffs. The real thing, you know? The rabbi had a nice watch, got it for I don't know what. When he was with the shul for 50 years, they gave him a watch. Beautiful, expensive gold watch. Shmuley couldn't help himself, and he stole the watch. But he's feeling a bit bad, so he goes up to the rabbi, and he says, Rabbi, what should somebody do if they stole a watch? So the rabbi says, you should immediately return it to the owner. So Shmuley says, but what if the owner doesn't want the watch back? So the rabbi says, in that case, you wouldn't need to return it. So Shmuley says, Rabbi, would you like the watch? And the rabbi says, no, I told you, give it to the owner. So Shmuley says, but the owner just told me he doesn't want it. In other words, so the rabbi says, in that case, keep the watch. So Shmuley got, you know, he got out of it on a technicality. You know, like these guys who get off, you know, in law, you wouldn't know about such a thing, but in law, somebody, you get off on a technicality, and either you're a terrible, you're a murderer, you clearly killed...
He deceived the rabbi,
you know, I want to protect the innocent, I'll just use initials for the next thing. But let's say a person's name was OJ, and he killed this woman, and he got off, you know, on silly technicalities, he got off, right? Clearly he killed, got off. So what do you say in such a case? Wisdom and prophecy. Prophecy is the knowledge of the future, and wisdom is such a deep understanding that it's, you see what the inevitable that's going to come from the act. In all these cases, there is a consequence. Even if you get off, even if Shmuley's, you know, deceives the rabbi and he gets away with a watch, and even in a kosher way, you haven't really deceived. Something is broke. There is always a consequence. Every action has a reaction. Every spiritual, even if the reaction is not in this material world, but it's a spiritual reaction, somehow the person has been defiled. I'll tell you, you know, on a beautiful custom on practiced in many, 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 many homes for millennia, in on Pesach, on Passover, where the children steal the Afikoman. Now, at a certain point of the Pesach Seder, you're not allowed to proceed until you have the Afikoman. And the kids, it's part of the Passover fun, they steal the Afikoman, and then they hold the whole party up for ransom. They say, okay, you want to proceed? Well, you need to have the Afikoman. And then they start negotiating, and this is where Jewish people get their good negotiating skills. It starts at a young age. They start negotiating, well, I want that bike, you know, give me the bike. And then the father has to agree to the bike, otherwise he's not going to get back the Afikoman. They're not going to be able to continue the Pesach Seder and conclude it. The father's no choice, and that's how the extortion works on the Pesach during the Pesach Seder. Now, there are many people, in my home included, where we do not do this. We do not encourage the children to steal the Afikoman. Why? It's all in good fun, and it's just, it makes the kids excited. It's one of the highlights of the Pesach Seder for most kids. One of the highlights for sure. And why do we discourage it? And it's based on a Talmudic passage where the Talmud discusses the question if you're allowed to steal from a thief. Are you allowed to steal from a thief? Okay, so somebody went and stole something. Are you allowed to now steal from the thief? So technically you're not stealing from a legitimate owner. So technically you're not actually contravening any law. Stealing from a thief is not stealing from a legitimate owner. So therefore, one would assume that it is permissible. And technically it is, but the Talmud says, yeah, okay, it's permissible, but you have now tasted the taste of stealing. In other words, there is a consequence. You may have, technically you didn't steal, but you have tasted thievery. And because you've tasted thievery, it has a very negative effect on your soul. And so even though it's all in good fun and it keeps the kids actively involved in the Pesach Seder, we don't do it because we don't want them to taste the taste of thievery. And that is with all sins. So even if you get away with it, there is always a consequence. Which brings me to the third and final joke. This one is about a young boy who is starting school. And his, what do they call it, helicopter mother, is very worried, very concerned. And she says, my bubala, that's Yiddish. My shefela, that's Yiddish. These are terms of endearment, you know, my beloved, you know. My bubala, my shefela, you must be a good boy in school, my ketzela. You should come home, my tayrela. Right after school is over, tzaddikal, get onto the bus. I'm going to run out of adjectives soon. Get onto the bus and come straight home to your mother, my precious angel, my malachal. All Yiddish expressions, right? And so anyway, the boy goes off. The mother's panicked, is worried the whole day. She's waiting an hour before the bus comes at the bus stop, waiting. Finally, the bus arrives. Her boy gets off and she says, my title, my, what ones didn't I use yet? My beauty, my shenkite. Tell me, what did you learn in your first day in school? And he says, ma, I learned that my name is David. So it's interesting. Things have names, right? And obviously we use names to identify a thing. So if you want to get my attention, you would say Avraham, and I would turn around and you would have my attention. So you need my name to call my attention. But let me ask you a question. Let's take this bottle. So if you would describe this bottle, what kind of descriptions could we give it? Well, it's a water bottle. It's you could give the height, the dimensions, how it holds 450 milliliters of water. It's sparkling. You could say the brand name. You have many different descriptions of this thing. Now, if I would hide this and you'd never seen it, and I would start describing it, the more I describe it, the clearer it becomes in your mind. But you don't have it. If I give you the actual bottle, then you have all those descriptions. All those descriptions are implied in this. Now, what is this? What is the essence of something? What is the essence of something? What is the thing that gives rise to all the definitions of the thing, but is not... Now, none of those definitions are really an accurate description of the thing, because you say it's so much millimeter. You know, just because you had something with these dimensions doesn't mean you have this particular instance of the bottle. You see, there's more than one of these type of bottles that share a lot of the same characteristics. So what is an essence of anything? How do you define the essence from all which all definitions accrue, but how do you define that essence of what something is? And the answer, you don't. You can't. Because the essence, ironically, which is the source of all the definitions of what a thing is, also transcends any definition. So, who are you? You can say, you can tell me your name, you can tell me your birth date. They don't have social insurance numbers here, do they? Social insurance number, come from where I come from. You can tell me your history, you can tell me who your parents were, you can tell me all sorts of things, what you like, what you don't like. But you cannot tell me your essence. I don't have who you are. But you walk into a room and I have who you are. There was a story they tell about the Alter Rebbe that he was once playing with his baby on his lap. And his baby grabbed his beard. And he said, in Yiddish, he said, "Is das Zayde? Is this my grandfather?" And his grandfather said, "Nein, das ist Zaydi's Bart. This is Zaydi's beard." So he grabbed his ear and he said, "Is das Zayde?" And he said, "No, das ist Zaydi's Ohr. This is his ear." He grabbed his nose, this is Zaydi's nose. Each part that he pointed to was not his Zaydi. Alright, so after a while he got bored, he went off his Zaydi's lap, he went off to the side, and his grandfather remained in the room. A little bit later, the grandson went into another room, and a little bit later he called out, "Zaydi, Zaydi!" So the grandfather got a shock, he jumped up, he ran into the room. As soon as he ran into the room, the grandson was smiling, he pointed to his grandfather, he said, "Ata da Zaydi." He says, "This is grandfather. This is the definition of grandfather." Because he ran into the room. And that is the... So what's the essence of a person? The essence of a person, because it transcends any definition, can never be harmed in any way. The essence of a person transcends all definitions. So therefore... we can understand a very interesting discussion. The sages say that for Yom Kippur to work, Yom Kippur is the day of Teshuvah. For Yom Kippur to work, you have to actively participate in repentance. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi argues with the sages, and he said no. He says, "Itzumo yishal Yom HaKippur mechaper." The day, the essence of the day of Yom Kippur itself already achieves atonement. You don't have to do anything. Just survive through a Yom Kippur, acknowledge that it's Yom Kippur, fast perhaps, but acknowledge that it's Yom Kippur, and you're atoned for all your sin. By the way, it's interesting, the word atonement is actually three, you could split into three words. It's at-one-ment. Okay? Atonement is at-one-ment. Because what is atonement? Atonement in the Jewish sense is when you become unified again with your essence. That's what teshuva is. Teshuva is return. You return back to your essence. What's your essence? Your essence is something that is beyond definition and therefore cannot be harmed by any action that you do. Actions are very external things, right, that we do. So anything that you do, any behavior that you behave, will only harm a very external part of your personality, but your innermost part of your personality will remain intact forever. That can never be harmed. And teshuvah is the process of getting back to that. So not that you're Tyler or Shefel or Ketzel or Tzadikel or Shenkite or whatever, it's that you're David. It's the essence of who you are, and you get back to that essence, and that is what teshuvah is at one moment. Any questions, concerns, comments, criticisms? Hopefully everyone will return next week.